Hello and welcome to the August 5th, 2025 Annals of Internal Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm here to let you know about what's new on annals.org. I know our listeners are busy, so let's get right to the new articles. First is a prospective cohort study that examined the associations of different physical activity patterns with all-cause cardiovascular and cancer mortality among adults with diabetes. Researchers studied data from 51,650 adults with self-reported diabetes who participated in the National Health Interview Survey between 1997 and 2018. Current guidelines recommend at least 150 minutes per week of moderate to vigorous physical activity distributed across a minimum of 3 days, but many people, even those who are physically active, don't follow the recommended exercise pattern. The researchers categorized survey respondents into 4 activity patterns: inactive, insufficiently active, defined as moderate to vigorous physical activity less than 150 minutes per week; weekend warrior, defined as moderate to vigorous physical activity 150 minutes or more per week in 1 or 2 sessions; and regularly active, defined as moderate to vigorous physical activity 150 or more minutes per week across at least 3 sessions. The researchers found that insufficiently active, weekend warrior, and regularly active participants had lower risk for all-cause and cardiovascular mortality compared to inactive participants. Weekend warriors and regularly active participants had a 21% and 17% lower all-cause mortality risk, respectively, and 33% and 19% lower risks of cardiovascular mortality, respectively, compared with inactive participants. There were fewer differences in cancer mortality among the various exercise patterns. Next is the report of a target trial emulation that compared the effect of glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist, or GLP-1 receptor agonist, versus dipeptidyl peptidase 4, or DPP-4 inhibitors, as the second-line therapy for type 2 diabetes on the risk for dementia among older adults. The study found no clear difference in dementia incidence between GLP-1 receptor agonists and DPP-4 inhibitor users. Clinical onset of dementia occurred in 4% of the GLP-1 receptor agonist group and 4.5% of the DPP-4 inhibitor group, and there was no difference in the estimated 30-month risk for dementia diagnosis between the groups. These findings were consistent across several sensitivity analyses. However, subgroups analyses suggest that GLP-1 receptor agonists may have an advantage over DPP-4 inhibitors in adults younger than 75 years. The authors call for randomized trials with longer follow-up to better understand whether GLP-1 receptor agonists affect dementia risk. Urgent care clinics are increasingly the place where Americans without easy access to a personal physician seek care. But there is concern about the appropriateness of care provided in these clinics that provide episodic care without an established physician-patient relationship. The next article assessed the appropriateness of antibiotic, glucocorticoid, and opioid prescribing in urgent care visits in the U.S. Researchers used commercial and Medicare databases to study urgent care outpatients of all ages between 1st of January 2018 and 31st of December 2022. The primary outcome was inappropriate oral antibiotic, glucocorticoid, and opioid prescription fills for the 10 most common clinical categories. Antibiotic appropriateness was based on established consensus schemes. Glucocorticoid appropriateness was based on literature defining glucocorticoid use as generally inappropriate for upper respiratory infection, sinusitis, acute bronchitis, infectious diseases, and otitis media. Opioid prescription fills were considered generally inappropriate. Of 10,773,218 patients identified from over 22 million urgent care visits, 12.4%, 9.1%, and 1.3% of visits led to antibiotic, glucocorticoid, and opioid prescriptions, respectively. Antibiotics were frequently filled for never appropriate indications. 40.8% of glucocorticoid prescriptions were inappropriately filled to treat acute bronchitis. Opioid prescriptions were commonly inappropriately filled for non-back musculoskeletal pain, abdominal pain, and digestive symptoms, sprains, and strains. The study highlights the need for stewardship programs to reduce inappropriate urgent care prescribing. Many people suffer from symptoms that they attribute to sequela of COVID-19, and many questions remain unanswered about so-called long COVID. Next is an article that sought to determine associations between social determinants of health at the time of acute SARS-CoV-2 infection and subsequent risk for long COVID. Researchers studied data from 3,787 adults enrolled in the RECOVER adult study between October 2021 and November 2023 who had acute SARS-CoV-2 infection with the Omicron variant. Participants completed comorbidity and social determinants of health surveys at baseline and long COVID symptom surveys at 6 months follow-up. The researchers used the Healthy People 2030 categorizations for social determinants of health to identify domains of individual-level risk social factors that included economic instability, education and language access barriers, healthcare access and quality challenges, and lack of social or community support, and two area-level measures from zip code data, neighborhood poverty, and household crowding. The outcome measured was meeting the criteria for likely long COVID from the 2024 update of the RECOVER Adult Long COVID Research Index based on the 6-month patient-reported symptom survey. The researchers found that persons with financial hardship, food insecurity, less than a college education, and healthcare access challenges were at a higher risk for developing long COVID. Living in a zip code with higher household crowding was also associated with greater risk of long COVID. Secondary analysis found that a greater number of social risk factors within most domains conferred a higher risk for long COVID. The findings suggest a persisting contribution of social risk factors to the disparities exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Next is a brief research report that challenges the frequent practice of placing all persons of Asian descent in the same demographic group. This study assessed cardiovascular risk factors and disease mortality among Asian Indian, Chinese, and Filipino American subgroups. The findings revealed that each subgroup has distinct cardiovascular challenges, with Filipino Americans having the highest mortality across most cardiovascular conditions. The results can inform tailored screening, diagnosis, and prevention strategies to the unique risk profiles of Asian Indian, Chinese, and Filipino Americans. High tibial osteotomy is a surgical procedure used to treat patients with medial compartmental knee osteoarthritis and varus alignment, commonly referred to as bowed legs. Researchers randomized 145 middle-aged adults with this form of arthritis to either receive non-surgical management for 3 months followed by high tibial osteotomy or non-surgical management alone. Patients who declined to be randomly assigned participated in a preference arm. Non-surgical management was consistent with guideline recommendations and included exercise, weight management, and pain medications when needed. The primary outcome was a change in articular cartilage thickness in the medial tibiofemoral compartment from baseline to 2 years of follow-up. Secondary outcomes included patient-reported outcomes and gait biomechanics. The study found that osteotomy slowed the progression of structural joint damage and improved clinical outcomes in study participants. The findings were consistent across the randomized and preference trial arms. Next is a report of a phase 3 multicenter randomized controlled trial that compared rituximab with conventional strategies for the induction of remission in patients with eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. The trial found rituximab was not superior to the conventional strategy for inducing remission in patients with this condition. In non-severe disease, glucocorticoids alone remain the standard of care, whereas cyclophosphamide remains the standard for patients with more severe disease. Approved treatment options for children and adolescents with type 2 diabetes are limited. Canagliflozin is a sodium glucose co-transporter 2 inhibitor approved for the treatment of adults. Next is a randomized trial that studied the safety and effectiveness of canagliflozin in children and adolescents with type 2 diabetes. The trial enrolled 171 children and adolescents aged 10 years and older who had type 2 diabetes and hemoglobin A1Cs of 6.5 to 11%. Patients were randomized to 100 milligrams of canagliflozin or placebo. Participants with hemoglobin A1Cs 7% or higher and estimated GFRs of greater than or equal to 60 at week 12, were re-randomized at week 13 to either remain on canagliflozin 100 milligrams or placebo or uptitrated to 300 milligrams or placebo. At week 26, hemoglobin A1C reduction from baseline was significantly greater in the intervention group than in the placebo group. An accompanying editorial discusses the findings and how they inform a much-needed expansion of treatment options for youth with type 2 diabetes. While weight loss has been shown to improve pain and function in persons with knee osteoarthritis, the role of weight loss in persons with hip osteoarthritis is less clear. The next article aimed to identify its role by conducting a randomized trial that compared outcomes among 70 persons with hip osteoarthritis and overweight or obesity assigned to exercise alone or exercise plus a very low-calorie diet. The primary outcome was 6 months change in hip pain severity. Secondary endpoints included other measures of hip pain, physical function, quality of life, body weight, body composition, and adverse events. The bottom line was that adding a weight loss diet to exercise did not change hip pain, but improved most secondary outcomes. Engineering infection controls include a wide range of interventions used indoors to reduce occupants' exposure to respiratory pathogens. The role of such controls gained a lot of interest during and in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The authors of the next article conducted a scoping review to identify and describe primary studies evaluating the effects of engineering interventions designed to reduce the spread of respiratory infections transmitted indoors. English language primary research articles evaluating engineering infection control interventions for Medline and a number of other databases through December 2023 were eligible. Publication information, population characteristics, intervention details, and all relevant outcomes were abstracted by a reviewer and verified by a second, more senior reviewer. The authors identified 672 studies published between 1929 and December 2023. Most, 606 of the 672, evaluated environmental samples only, with only 57 including human subjects and 9 including sentinel animal subjects. About half of the studies included at least one intervention classified as pathogen inactivation, with fewer involving pathogen removal or air exchange dilution. Across all studies, about half measured the quantity of viable non-pathogenic organisms from air samples, followed by the quantity of non-biologic particulates or viable pathogenic organisms. Harms such as toxic byproducts were rarely measured. The review identified substantial heterogeneity in available evidence and many gaps in knowledge. Because disability is a byproduct of socio-structural barriers that impede access to full societal participation, people with disabilities may be predisposed to loneliness. If true, this could compound health disparities in this vulnerable population. To learn more about loneliness burden among persons with disabilities, the authors of the next article characterized loneliness severity in two national samples of persons with disability, stratified by disability types. In conclusion, they found an exceptionally high burden of loneliness among working-age persons with disability. Further research is needed to understand varying drivers of loneliness in this population. Also new is an update of the American College of Physicians Living Guideline on the pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic treatment of major depression. This latest update surveyed new evidence published September 2024 through March 2025. While a few new studies were identified, the evidence identified in this surveillance did not single a reason to change the prior conclusions of the Living Systematic Review, and the ACT reaffirmed their recommendations. Also new is a commentary on the recent recommendations for pneumococcal vaccine in U.S. adults aged 50 years and older, and a research and reporting methods article on using prediction models to guide treatment decisions. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening. Go to annals.org for the articles I've mentioned here and many others. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.